during the race, you know, kids and other people are watching the runners go across the bridge, and we don't want to give them the impression that it's okay to cross railroad bridges or even be on the track anytime because it's just unsafe, and we don't want that to happen. A kid can watch, see somebody get on the bridge, and they think it's okay, and they do it themselves, and it's not okay. It's unsafe, and we just don't want anyone to get hurt.
Three, two, one. 3 years ago, UAF began raising parking fees in order to balance the books. Now administrators say they'll hold fees at this year's levels, even though it means a $600,000 shortfall next year. Charlie Dexter heads up the parking committee that recommended the moratorium. He says higher fees have priced some people out of parking on campus, and another hike would force even more people out, costing the school. But he says the freeze means the $600,000 will have to come out of some other department's budget unless the school can figure out another way to raise money.
And if, for example, every student paid $5 a credit hour, as they do right now for parking, whether they park or not, it's just another fee that's added. And if every staff and faculty took a 10-cent an hour pay cut, and we didn't even have decals, we just said, that's it. We're going to capture the revenue from staff and faculty and just charge the students. We don't need decals, and we hit the program assessment target.
Since staff and faculty who don't drive to campus would also be charged the pay cut, Dexter admits the notion will likely meet some resistance. But he quickly adds the idea is merely one in a host of others the campus as a whole will debate before administrators act. But some members of the staff council already have questions about parking revenue funds and how they're spent. Karen Enox is on the council and the parking committee.
A tremendous amount of money has been taken out of the parking account for different things, and we would like a breakdown on what those expenses were, where that money actually went, and what it was used for.
So far, says Enox, administrators have only produced broad outlines of where the funds are going. She says the staff council will want details before they'll endorse any money-making plan. This issue is on hold this summer. The traffic committee will take up the matter again in the fall, then turn over ideas to other bodies on campus for review and debate. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
In November 1994, the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Trustee Council adopted its restoration plan for areas affected by the oil spill. Part of that plan includes a list of resources and services injured by the spill. Molly McCammon, Executive Director of the Trustee Council, says that list has undergone its first major review.
What we've done here is put out for public review some suggested changes to what is referred to as the list of resources and services injured by the spill. This is a list that maybe has a little bit more, seems to have a little bit more authority than it really has, because certainly it's not a body count of all of the resources that were killed or injured by the spill.
The list includes birds and animals that were either killed in large numbers or genetically damaged by the spill. Last year, the council added Kittlitz's murrelets and common loons, and the current proposal adds three species of cormorants. Scientists recommended against adding black-legged kittiwakes and some scoters to the list because they didn't meet the damage criteria. The proposal also changes the recovery status of some species.
Based on the information that the council has gathered through its research and monitoring program, there are a couple of species that we're putting out for public comment, proposing changing from various categories, from either not recovering to recovering or from recovering to recovered or whatever.
McCammon says the proposal recommends upgrading the bald eagle to recovered. Pink salmon and sockeye salmon would be upgraded to recovering from the spill. McCammon says the changes are based on information gathered through the Trustee Council-funded studies, as well as studies from government agencies and Exxon Corporation.
Well, it's been 7 years since the spill occurred, and I think if anything, if nothing else, what we've learned is that it's very difficult to determine when full recovery has been achieved.
That's because there was very little baseline data collected prior to the spill, and because bird and animal populations vary a lot and are affected by many environmental factors. Since the draft was released, the council has received comments regarding pink salmon and comments asking the council to add damages to sockeye salmon populations in Ishami Bay in southwest Prince William Sound. The council requests written comments by June 15th so it can take action at its August meeting. In Valdez, I'm Shauna Simmons.
3, 2, 1. Cordova District Fishermen United received a $130,000 herring research grant after 1993's collapse of the Prince William Sound herring fishery. CDFU Executive Director Dorn Hawkser says the organization used the first $90,000 to lease sonar equipment and charter vessels for herring abundance surveys. She says by purchasing the sonar equipment with the remaining $40,000, more surveys will be possible.
It's kind of like that old saying, you can give a man a fish and he'll eat well for a day, or you can teach a man how to fish and he'll eat well for the rest of his life. I think the theory in concluding this grant is that if we acquire the equipment that can be used year after year, it is a more effective application of the dollars than buying specific surveys year after year. So this is what we're endeavoring to do now.
Hawkser says CDFU will own the equipment and donate it to Fish and Game, which can also upgrade or modify it.
And it will be available, depending on basically their needs and the needs of the fishermen, for other parties to use in the community as well. We're just really jazzed about the prospect of having this kind of opportunity available to help with management of the resource year after year after year.
John Wilcock of Fish and Game's Cordova office says the department now relies on Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Trustee Council funding for its herring surveys. Wilcock says it's not likely the department will be able to continue the same program once the Trustee Council funding ends, but having the sonar equipment will allow the department to continue surveying the fish. The Prince William Sound Science Center may also use the sonar equipment for herring research. According to CDFU, the cooperation of the three organizations could lead to additional grants from sources that look favorably on resource management partnerships. In Valdez, I'm Greg Williams.
There's rocks all over here, Tom.
A half dozen students from Pearl Creek Elementary in Fairbanks plunge their shovels into the rocky soil behind their school. They're planting a seismometer, while other students document the work on video. These kids are part of an NSF-funded program that teams them and their teachers with a working scientist. In this case, seismologist Bob Hammond, who's overseeing the installation.
It would have been really fun when I was a kid if somebody had come to me and said, hey, let's set up a seismograph station at your school. I mean, I would have gone ape over that. So it's kind of like I'm reliving the childhood that I couldn't have by doing this.
NSF and school district officials hope Hammond's knowledge and enthusiasm rubs off. Many who chart how our young do in school worry not enough of them understand or care about science. They hope this program will turn that around. Hammond is working with several schools. He's helped install seismometers in McGrath and Grayling. 3 times a week, students at all three sites join by computer to exchange questions and answers with Hammond and each other. They also analyze the data using donated software. McGrath teacher Norv Darlin says the electronic link is putting his students on a par with their urban peers.
We really have more limited resources for information. In Anchorage or Fairbanks, they have a lot of scientists more locally available. They have bigger libraries and just more resources for information. So that's been real good for us.
Back in Fairbanks, Darlin's colleague, Martha Coplin, who teaches at Pearl Creek, says while Partners in Science seeks to engage students' enthusiasm, there'll also be some testing to see if they do better in the classroom. And says Coplin, there's an outside evaluator who's been up twice.
And we have been collecting information for him, such as you see the kids with a video camera they had been using earlier. We've been taking video coverage throughout the project to see if there is any change as the kids become more and more familiar with what they're doing with the computer equipment and so forth.
One of Coplin's students, fourth grader Kelly Hansen, was behind both the shovel and video camera as students buried the seismometer. She finds science fun and a socially responsible future profession.
I want to grow up to be a scientist. science is just an interesting thing. And if we know a lot about science, the more we know about science, the more we know about Earth and know about how to take care of the Earth.
I saw down the hole.
As they tapped the last of the soil in place over the seismometer, other students echoed Hansen's views. Their teacher, Copland, hopes if this program is a success, it will expand to include junior and senior high students as well. That way, she says, the elementary school students can build on the skills and knowledge they gathered this spring. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Three, two, one. Roughly a 250,000 people see Denali National Park every summer, and once they're through the gate, just about all of them travel by bus. Visitors take a guided wildlife tour from ARA Services, the park's concessionaire, or they can catch a shuttle. Park Superintendent Steve Martin says the shuttle offers basic access.
Visitors can get on and off the bus all the way from beyond Savage River to Wonder Lake or Kantishna and hike, sightsee. They can stay on the bus if they wish to and just ride to Eielson and then take a return trip.
The shuttle used to be free, but in these leaner times, the Park Service has turned management over to ARA, attached a fee and a reservation system. Starting in February, travelers can use an 800 number to book about 40% of the seats. Martin says the remainder are sold at the visitor's center 2 or 3 days before they can be used.
So it's a mix of being able to book way in advance or immediately on the spot for people who just show up and want transportation.
But the system that works well for the Park Service and most visitors may not be doing all it can for bed and breakfast owners in Fairbanks. Rose Pagg is president of the Fairbanks B&B Association. She says the waiting period loses money for her members.
What happens is you have people coming in or up the highway, either on the train or in a car. They will hit the park, find out there's a 2 to 3 day waiting period, and decide, well, we're just going to stay here and see if we can get on the shuttle into the park, and end up having to cancel a day or all their days in Fairbanks.
Pag would like to buy blocks of tickets to have on hand for her guests.
We as B&B owners would buy them, sell them to our customers for the same price that we bought them. They could go down there and use them.
To get those tickets now, she has to have names and dates, which don't always come before the reserved seats are sold out. Her only other choice is to drive to Denali to reserve the 2 day wait spots. Bob Sini, ARA's regional manager, says the decision not to sell open blocks of tickets was to protect the little guy.
To preclude package wholesalers from buying up all the advanced reservations without names and then trying to sell those. So this allowed a lot easier access for the smaller travelers, the individuals, state residents, and so on.
PAG is hoping the Park Service and ARA will be willing to make an adjustment and allow some block ticket sales, or permit people to purchase the 2 day wait tickets from Fairbanks or Anchorage, as well as in the park. That way, she says, B&B or hotel guests can enjoy their stay in Alaska's cities without missing the park, and local entrepreneurs won't lose on the transaction. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McInnes.
The Department of Environmental Conservation, Fish and Game, and the Department of Natural Resources face cuts of 10% or more this year. University of Alaska Southeast Dean John Pugh wonders how long before the cuts interfere with safe resource development.
In Alaska, we're always talking about responsible resource development, and if we're going to do that, we need to keep strong funding for the resource agencies to enable them to help with the responsible development. And when I looked at the reductions this year in the budget, the resource agencies took a disproportionate share of the cuts, and I'm real concerned about that for the future of resource development in the state.
Agency officials agree that cuts are necessary, but Marty Rutherford of the Alaska Department of Natural Resources says she's concerned about how the cuts are made.
The discussion is not one of whether or not we should make cuts. Everybody agrees that we need to make cuts. It's how quickly we make those cuts and where we make those cuts. So So to me, and I think everybody else within the resource agencies, it's that pragmatic and realistic approach with long-term focus that would protect us and recognize that you've got to have adequate monies available to the agencies for them to do their job effectively.
Michelle Brown, Commissioner of the Department of Environmental Conservation, says the legislature is cutting several essential services that will affect industry as well as citizens. For example, she points to the DEC regulation of housing subdivisions and sewage systems.
What we have found is if the subdivision is not properly designed so that each lot can have an on-lot system, somebody may build a system and then it'll flood the area and you'll have raw sewage on the ground. That's a serious health problem. Or in the alternative, they'll find they can't put a system at all on that lot and they hold in this lot that becomes worthless. So there's a property value issue here.
ARCO spokeswoman Suzanne Lagoni agrees that without enough money, the agencies will not function well, and that would slow down the permitting process.
I think it's important because we do need to keep the processes moving, and we need to make sure that both industry and agencies are staffed in a way that the processes can move along, decisions can be made, and good environmentally sound development can occur.
One suggestion includes having industry pay the state for regulation. Backers of the Fort Knox gold mine near Fairbanks kicked in to fund regulators at the Department of Natural Resources. But doing so, says Anita Williams, head geologist for the Nana Regional Corporation, leads business owners to question what they're paying for.
I think when the state does make regulations, the legislature and the governor and all that, they do need to look at the implications of those regulations and whether the state can supply legitimately the manpower to implement those regulations. In order for industry to operate, we'll probably have to ante up some bucks.
While business and regulators are committed to working together to achieve common goals, the relationship is far from easy, and doing so in times of declining budgets may only make the relationship more difficult. In Fairbanks, I'm Amanda Russell.
The main show at Alaskaland's Palace Saloon mixes pleasant songs, humor, and history into a review that offends no one, hoping to attract everyone. The summer tourists that flock to Fairbanks' theme park are the saloon's bread and butter. But on Friday and Saturday nights, after the review, the Palace hosts another production guided by very different aims.
You ain't no sissy ways, I wanna squeeze your private part.
The Late Show blends biting sexual and political satire with raw-edged rock and roll to draw locals rather than visitors. Melinda Mattson, who's had a hand in both shows, says while they differ in expression, they share a bottom line.
We have very strong commercial concerns. I mean, this is a business. This is a for-profit enterprise. I think we've taken a couple of big risks in this. For example, a love song that we do, a beautiful ballad that's sung by two men, a love song. That's taking it out on the edge, not of comedy, but of turning the comedy into something else. And whether people get it or not, I don't know.
The purpose of a man is to love somebody. The purpose of a man is to find someone who cares. So come on, baby. Please, darling, let's try to work this out together, man to man.
Bruce Hansen wrote the love ballad and the rest of the show's music. He says the piece caps a sketch lampooning the passionate response a library display on gay history triggered earlier this year in Fairbanks. Hansen says humor as a way of waking people up to their prejudices.
The thing we tend to look at is narrow-mindedness, and that's what we'll make fun of. Frankly, and quite personally, I'd like to have the people who are so narrow-minded about two men being in love be a little upset by that, be a little uncomfortable with it, deal with it, face it.
Despite the uncomfortable material, Hansen and Mattson and their producer are banking their production will please audiences. Elena Lee Kramer says Fairbanks theatergoers aren't provincial, though she can't say the same for the local paper. This February, she directed a humorous whodunit about sex in all its guises. She says while it packed the houses, she had to revise her advertising copy before the paper would accept it. She thinks Fairbanks is ready for a full-time theater dealing with adult themes.
I had done the same thing that a lot of people did, which was said, it's too much for Fairbanks. And I just came to a point in my life where I felt like I needed to push the boundaries. And I got results better than I ever expected for the community, all of Fairbanks really going for it.
Kramer is planning her next production for the fall. In the meantime, the Palace Late Show caters to those looking for more spice in their theater. Besides sex, the show also takes aim at state politicians and media personalities, including a shrill talk show host who's into leather. The show runs Friday and Saturday nights at 10 o'clock. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Three, two, one. The arrival of summer to the interior is synonymous with the arrival of the first barges down the Yukon River. Before airplanes became an everyday mode of travel, barges brought most manufactured goods and prepared foods to river communities. Things have changed, but people still anticipate the barges because it's the cheapest way to transport large items like new cars, refrigerators, and building supplies. And this year, the barge will be loaded down with more than ordinary household items. Utana Barge Lines will be transporting mining equipment to Galena. USMX Vice President Paul Valenti says activity at the Illinois Creek Mine will be fast and furious for the next 3 months.
We should actually be pouring our first gold before the end of September. So what our general plan is to get our heap leach pad constructed, essentially completed around the 1st of August, so we could start to load ore, which means we'll be starting to mine probably sometime in mid to late July.
USMX and their partner D.H. Blattner & Sons eventually plan to hire about 100 people to staff the silver and gold hard rock mine. Valenti says an overwhelming number of locals have applied to fill those summer positions. Notifications of hire should arrive in the mail over the next 2 weeks. The first barge is expected in Galena this week, but locals have already been testing the waters. Many Galena residents celebrated the Memorial Day weekend by pulling boats out of storage for trips down to Caltech and up to Ruby. After a month of breakup conditions blocking travel on the river, people here are ready for the summer. In Galena, I'm Teresa Bacher.
Three, two, one. Whether it's reaching across roadless miles with the internet or a classroom with the proper teaching technique, Superintendent John Monahan pursues the idealistic bumper sticker slogan, "It takes a whole village to raise a child." In today's diverse, fast-changing world, for Monahan, traditional educational goals have to share time with broader values.
Not everything that you want to teach is in the books. It's in the newspapers. It's what's taking place in the community. You might have your curriculum that defines we're going to learn this about math and we're going to learn this about science. You have other goals that we hope that students have to be good citizens in our communities.
Monahan's philosophy may face an acid test in making the transition from the rural schools of the Western Interior to the diverse environment of Fairbanks, where one particular challenge tops his list.
It's getting along. It's relationships with people. Teaching one another to appreciate the differences in people. And I think as a district, staff need to model that, you know, from the superintendent, school board, custodians, teachers, everybody involved in the process so that students pick up on that and that they start to live that on a day-to-day interaction with their peers.
The warm, fuzzy style of Superintendent Monahan has endeared him to the Iditarod district. Although occasional hard-nosed budget and personnel decisions have ruffled a few, and not everyone shares his fervor for the high-tech, Monahan's worked closely with a relatively small staff, board, and student body spread out geographically from the Kuskokwim River to the Yukon and Lake Minchumina. It's been Monahan's job to keep Bush education innovative in times of tightening budgets. Teacher Bob Kuhn has spent 6 years working alongside him.
When I was teaching in Grayling, and he was the principal in Grayling, I got this idea to go on a bike trip And most principals, when approached with a project such as this, which was a 2,000-mile bike ride from Seattle to Albuquerque, New Mexico, would probably look at you and say, you're bananas, or you're crazy. John said, that sounds like a great idea. What can we do? How can we get this thing off the ground and functioning? He didn't close doors to ideas.
Monahan's willingness to try new things also brought district employees collective bargaining, and to three sites, a pilot program which proved the merits of the one-room schoolhouse philosophy. All the innovation is time-consuming, though, both behind the scenes and on the road, ensuring follow-through and funding. At 36, Monahan draws on the experience of a much older man. The Midwesterner entered college at 16, eventually earning a doctorate in administration. Both urban and rural teaching experience have also marked his meteoric career. A true neatnik, there's no clutter around Monahan, surprising for a family man with two young children. When he's not at the educational grindstone, the easygoing Monahan is at home with his wife, Jane, enjoying kids Kyle and Kelsey, a good sauna, the music of James Taylor and John Hyatt, and reading. A copy of the popular Chicken Soup for the Soul is on his table. Always contributors to the community, the Monahans will be missed after they leave McGrath. Their home has been shared by a boarding student for the past 4 years and often has been a gathering place for friends and children.
It's been a wonderful experience for us. The Iditarod School District, all the friends that we've made here, the personnel, have been great people. We're really going to miss the area.
In McGrath, I'm Dan Broth.
If the meek have any plans about inheriting the earth, Mother Lawrence will be right there making sure everyone gets a fair share. For some 25 years, Alice Lawrence has devoted her life to taking care of others. She calls her anchorage house God's Place, where a person can get free food and free clothes.
The Lord brought to my attention that this year that my father, during Depression, Mother would fix these big old pots of food, and he and Mother would just give it out to the neighborhood. And so I'm just doing what they did.
Lawrence's kitchen's open 6 days a week, and she does the Lord's work in a public fashion. She helps the people that others may ignore, and she confronts those who stray.
I don't care who you are. If you come off the street and need a place to sleep or just need a hug. In fact, even gang leaders, because I'll go down the street with a baseball bat and I will sit in front of crack house till it closes. Because I tell them, you're not coming to my neighborhood and know it's prostitution, crack houses or crack dens or whatever they call it.
Lawrence exudes a combination of compassion, forgiveness, and tough love. Welfare, maybe for a little while, but if you've got two good legs, she says, then go get a job. To those who have stolen her wallet, she'll pray for them, too.
What can you do? Just pray for the people, because see, there's good and bad everywhere. And some good people do bad things. You know, they make them bad because they mess up. Just their mind's not with it. I don't care how much education they got. Some people at one point will mess up, and you've just got to love them even more.
Lawrence recently won the Presidential Service Award for her dedication. She traveled to Washington, met the first family, and visited with other committed volunteers, many of whom share her definition of neighbor.
We're all part of that same pie. And even if you think that you've overcome and got out of that, we're all still part of that same pie. And if one's hurting, we're all hurting. And we need to be more conscious of the people around us. You don't have to open your doors to them, but open your heart and just, when you see someone that's in need, see what you can do to help. Start, do more volunteer work.
Yes, ma'am. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter. As salmon prices have tumbled, some fishers have been boosting their income by processing their own catch and selling it to brokers. In so doing, they've found a niche, some say a loophole, that's allowed them to sell salmon roe from mature fish, throwing the carcasses overboard. But last fall, the Department of Law ruled that such roe stripping by processors violated the state's salmon waste laws. Now, a proposal before the Department of Fish and Game would sanction roe stripping in limited cases, namely for nonprofit hatcheries. Rick Lauber, vice president of the Pacific Seafood Processors Association, says roe stripping constitutes wanton waste, and he doesn't believe Fish and Game can sanction the practice.
I think the legislature has made it very clear that they do not allow wanton waste in the roast stripping of salmon. They have to find a viable use for that product, and I do not consider stripping the roe and throwing the salmon away a use. That's a disuse.
Lauber says the proposal unjustly favors hatcheries. Interior fishers also oppose the exemption. Dan Albrecht of the Yukon River Drainage Fisheries Association says letting hatcheries profit from roe stripping avoids the bigger issue of overproduction.
The real concern is that there's no onus on the hatcheries to improve their management, cut back on production, and address the waste issue from a proactive way rather than just bailing them out and letting them sell the roe and dump the carcasses. And we feel that's unfair to fishermen throughout the state and grants an unfair advantage to an already heavily subsidized pink and chum industry in southeast and Prince William Sound.
But hatchery directors disagree. Lad McCauley, director of Juneau's Dipac Hatchery, says the real wanton waste occurs when mature fish return to their release area but go unharvested.
When they come into the terminal area, if they're still bright, those fish are still sold. Those are good fish. But as they sexually mature, the only value left, the only thing they have left, is the roe value. At this point in time, anyway. And if you were to throw the roe away, it just seems like that's what you would be calling a waste.
As for improving management, McCauley says it's impossible to know how many fish will remain after hatcheries take eggs for broodstock, so they're bound to have leftovers, which should rightly be used. But Don Amon, general manager for Southern Southeast Regional Aquaculture Association, says the regulation doesn't go far enough. He says it should be broadened to include fishers working the remote release areas.
We feel the regulations should be broad enough under very limited situations where it's a terminal area where the fish have no other place to spawn, and there are programs that were set up by the hatcheries to target the fishermen, that processors or fishermen should be allowed to go in there and extract the value of the eggs without having to put a low-quality fish product on the market.
Amon sees the regulations as only a temporary measure to fill in until food processors develop uses for pale flesh salmon. Fish and Game officials say they're considering a sunset clause to help limit the practice. The public comment period closed last week. The department expects to release its regulations soon. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
3, 2, 1. As vice president of the Chitna Dipnetters Association, Stan Bloom says the Copper River salmon aren't being managed for his group. He points to the record 300,000 red salmon harvested by commercial fishermen that are ending up on menus in Chicago and Seattle, while a fraction of the salmon due upriver have escaped the nets to satisfy the hunger of Alaskans. He says the situation is mismanaged.
The poor management that they did is they didn't verify that fish were going up the river before they held the first opening. And then after they had the first opening and they seen that they caught five times as many fish as they had anticipated, they still held another opening.
What gulls, Bloom, and other interior dip netters is their June 1st opening has been trimmed to only 24 hours, down 2 days from last year. Bloom thinks some 7,000 dip netters in Anchorage and Fairbanks are being penalized by the Fish Board's bias towards commercial interests. And says dip netter Jim Rowland, a missed opportunity to fish can make a dent in the pocketbook.
We end up with maybe 100 pounds of salmon in our freezer. Ends up costing me about $1 a pound because we go down there and share expenses. But if I had to buy 100 pounds of salmon at the store at $5 or $6 a pound, you can see there would be a huge difference in what it costs me for my yearly salmon.
Roland says his family has been catching Chitna salmon for years and they depend on it. Fish and Game biologist Andy Hoffman handles sports fishing for the Chitna area, and he says it's too soon to tell if the high commercial openings have hurt dip netters.
There's two reasons that harvest could be high. One is that it's a big run, and that's what we're hoping for. The other is that they're holding and not moving, and so they're fishing on the same fish. As far as what the impact on the upriver fisheries will be, right now we're seeing that they're not moving over the sonar, but still have to wait and see when they start moving what the numbers that go upstream are.
Hoffman says the numbers of fish that head upriver as the season develops follows the bell curve. This year, Fish and Game decided to set the openings to follow that curve, so as the number of fish swell, so do the chances to take them. Hoffman is aware of the dip netters' beef over fish allocations, and he thinks the Board of Fish's meeting in December may be an opportunity for them to change some quotas. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
3, 2, 1. Cordova Mayor Margie Johnson appeared on television and radio shows, handed out samples of the fish at a supermarket, and presented a king to the vice mayor of Seattle during the dedication of a new pier. Johnson's trip was paid for by a wine distributor, which brought her to 5 restaurants, demonstrating ways of cooking with the fish.
It was great. Everybody's really interested in Copper River King. We've got some great response for it. It's a highly coveted item in the restaurants there, and I think it's a great way to go.
Johnson says none of the restaurants had seen a mayor who was a salmon peddler before, but she thinks all mayors should push products for their towns. She also says it's a natural tie-in for her. Johnson operates the Reluctant Fisherman Inn, which serves as a specialty Copper River King chili. But when it comes to Chinook salmon, Johnson says simplicity is best.
I think the best way to eat Copper River King is just completely unadorned. It's such a superb product. It really speaks for itself. And the color is such that it makes such a beautiful and attractive presentation on the plate. It's just outstanding just with either poached or baked with fresh vegetables.
Commercial fishermen have pulled more than 24,000 kings from the Copper River in 2 openings this year. Johnson says she went to Seattle to celebrate the first run of the season and hopes to go back next year, also heading down the coast to Portland or San Francisco. In Valdez, I'm Greg Williams. Three, two, one. Alyeska spokeswoman Jennifer Rye says the projects have a combined price tag of $100 million. Both are scheduled to last 2 years. Work on the tank farm vapor system will reduce chances of an explosion from the leaking gas. Rice says crews will start this summer with the pipe most in need of replacement.
They will be replacing approximately 5,800 linear feet of piping, primarily in areas which have already experienced corrosion leaks, and piping that has been identified as more susceptible to potential corrosion.
Alyeska says the leaks are mostly a problem in the high-pressure carbon piping that leads to the crude oil storage tanks. Rice says crews will replace most of the remaining portion of that piping next year.
That's about another 5,700 linear feet of piping that will be replaced in 1997. So upon completion of the project, 99% of the high-pressure piping and about 30% of the low-pressure piping will be replaced with corrosion-resistant material.
Meanwhile, the tanker vapor recovery project will begin with berth 4 this summer. The berth will be out of service while the workers install the controls. Rice says berth 5 will get the controls and be out of service next summer. Berths 1 and 3 will not be part of the vapor recovery system, which will reduce benzene and other tanker emissions by more than 90%. Studies have shown Valdez with as much benzene in the air as urban areas like San Francisco, Los Angeles, and Boston. An Alyeska study attributed a quarter of the benzene to its terminal, but a study by the Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Council attributed 90% or more of the cancer-causing substance to the terminal. The new controls will bring the vapors to the tank farm, the powerhouse, or the terminal's incinerator. The system will also bring Alyeska into compliance with new Clean Air Act rules from the Environmental Protection Agency. Those rules require compliance in February of 1998, and Rice says the company will have no problem meeting that deadline. The piping work is being done by Alyeska contractors Price Otna and Vico. Rice says the company combined the two projects for simplicity's sake.
They both involve piping. They both tie into the vapor recovery system and the power plant, and because of that, it was just easier to combine them and run them as one project with one project manager.
She says the contractors are staging for the work now and should be ready to start this week. In Valdez, I'm Greg Williams.
At their last meeting, members of the McGrath City Council talked about the perennial problem, which arises each spring when dirt roads dry out and trucks, cars, and all-terrain vehicles send dust flying into residents' faces and homes. Council member and director of the McGrath Health Center, Brent Ursel, says the problem is just a pet peeve for most people.
But for a small percentage of the people that have a COPD, emphysema, and asthma, the dust does raise some health concerns for these people. And during the summertime when it is real hot, dry, and dusty, we do tend to see an increase in the people with asthma coming in with flare-ups and needing treatment and medications.
McGrath Mayor Glenn Hanway admits dust is a problem, but says most of the solutions suggested by council members, like stopping speeders with a radar gun or watering roads, just aren't financially practical.
We don't have $1,100 to buy a speed gun. With the maintenance money that's available over the course of the year, we don't have enough money to water the roads. And the only real way to solve the problem would be to pave the roads, and I don't see that happening either in the near future.
Mayor Hanway advocates motorists slowing down to 10 or 15 miles per hour as the most economical means of easing the local dust situation. The city of Galena, meanwhile, is pursuing a more definitive solution. Galena City Manager Chow Taylor says that last summer, the Department of Transportation applied a dust-inhibiting calcium-based binder to state and some city roads there.
It's great. It's greatly improved, Tom. It's made a very marked difference in the amount of dust that's in the air here.
City Manager Taylor says Galena is kicking in $10,000 this summer to buy enough binder to cover the city's 7 miles of roads. The state will be back again to help the city out and to reapply binder to its roads there. Taylor says after initial application, the binder must be reapplied in lessening amounts over following years. In McGrath, I'm Dan Bross.
Pauline Carlo wrote this song for her husband last spring after she heard the first robin. It's a love song. Phil Carlo died 4 years ago, and she's telling him, "What is this robin saying to me so lovingly? You took me all over the world, and here I am, lonely without you." In their youth, Carlo and others traveled the rivers to see their family and friends, but now people have moved to the cities and are living a different lifestyle. Athabasca Elders organized the annual Dinakinaga Conference 15 years ago to speak to the younger generation of leaders. They wanted to tell them how to take care of and respect their elders, but these days they've shifted their focus to documenting their history. In the past, young people learned their history watching and listening to their elders, but kids are different now, and Dinakinaga Director Don Lee says elders are not just relying on the oral tradition.
The elders came to consensus in that method was not working, and something, we had to do something before a large number of the elders passed away that had this invaluable knowledge, and they saw a large number of elders passing away last year, and there's a large number of elders passing away this year, and they finally gave us the mandate to say, go ahead, do this type of documentation. In the meantime, we're still trying to do things the traditional way.
As part of the conference, Doyon Foundation Director Miranda Wright is leading a discussion on how villages can pursue the repatriation of bones and burial items taken from their gravesites and communities. Wright says this workshop will also be an opportunity to assess individual beliefs of each of the villages regarding death, burial practices, and gravesites. These topics are traditionally Hutlani. People did not talk about them in public.
There's a lot of sensitive issues, and it's been very difficult for the people to have to deal with it. And the villages, most of the tribal councils are run by the younger generation, and so they're looking for direction from Dinakinaga on how they should proceed in a culturally appropriate way. And I mean, there is no protocol for repatriation. So they're looking for direction from the elders of what should we do and how should we proceed with this.
Wright says the Athabascan elders are beginning to talk about their beliefs, and this openness will lead to healing, which has to happen before they can complete the repatriation circle. In Nenana, I'm Teresa Bacher.
The Veterans Administration has taken another step in the long-standing controversy of how to best Vietnam. The Veterans Administration has taken another step in the long-standing controversy of how to best care for Vietnam veterans exposed to Agent Orange. The VA has added two more diseases to the list of those it considers caused by exposure to the herbicide used by the military in Vietnam. The VA says it will now cover prostate cancer and peripheral neuropathy, a neurological disorder that causes numbness, tingling, and weakness in arms and legs. Dr. Ken Green of the Fairbanks Vet Center says in addition to covering these two diseases, the VA is proposing legislation that could make medical care history.
The president is instructed VA to figure out to what extent spina bifida in children of veterans are affected and how they're best be treated. And this is the first time in the history of the VA that a service-related condition has been extended to the children, so this is a brand new field for VA.
Green says Vietnam veterans who have been exposed to Agent Orange should contact the VA regional office for a screening and to file a claim. In Fairbanks, I'm Fred Brantingham.
3, 2, 1. In a two-page memo, Transportation Commissioner Joe Perkins told Northern Region employees that an unspecified number of their peers had been punished. Citing confidentiality laws, DOT officials refused to name those reprimanded. The action caps a 5-month investigation prompted by complaints of sexual harassment and discrimination. Deputy DOT Commissioner Kurt Parkin says the reprimand, suspension, and resignation are the first steps toward solving a seemingly chronic problem at the Fairbanks headquarters.
It was just sort of bubbling along and reached a point where it just needed to have a fresh look, and that's why we hired an attorney to do an independent investigation of the whole work environment up there.
Among the problems the investigator uncovered were favoritism among senior staff, bias based on gender and appearance, and the failure of some employees to realize their remarks create a hostile work environment. Parkin says the commissioner has appointed a special employee who will review promotions and attempt to resolve the harassment and discrimination complaints.
It's just another person to kind of make sure that everybody stays on an even keel and we continue down the kind of this path that we're trying to go, that it's going to bring confidence back into the workplace.
Parkin also says Regional Director Tony Johansson is charged with developing a long-range plan to deal with problems. This isn't the first investigation into DOT's Northern Regional Office. In January, the Alaska State Employees Association conducted a fact-finding survey into complaints, and that same month, an independent arbiter issued a harshly worded ruling that took management to task for improperly passing over a female DOT employee in favor of a male. She instructed the DOT to give the job to the female. With help from John McWhorter, in Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Among other things, the circus show featured high wire acts, clowns, dancing Shetland ponies, acrobats, and a Chinese group of contortionists. I'd never been to a circus before and couldn't wait to see this one in action. As I walked towards the circus, I entered a petting zoo with exotic animals. I almost missed the lions lining the back wall until one roared directly behind me. I went back 3 times to look at the lions and 2 times to see the zebras. The children were full of excitement seeing and touching animals that most had only seen in nature specials and Disney cartoons. Circuses don't come often to Fairbanks. A pair of 2-story inflatable plastic jungle gyms were parked next to the zoo. Children lined up to bounce off walls and tumble down long slides. Inside the Carlson Center, it was a real 3-ring circus. Children bought trips on elephants around the first ring. Brave men and children stood at the 2nd ring to get their pictures taken wearing a pair of snakes, and girls flocked to the 3rd ring to ride tiny Shetland ponies. I really enjoyed the animals and the clown on stilts. He was nearly 12 feet tall. It was fun watching the kids go nuts over the elephants and ponies, but I was not prepared for the reality of the main event. As people filed into their seats, the announcer kept everyone busy, leading screaming children in a chant, one side of the arena yelling, "Pizza Hut delivers," and the other side chanting, "New chicken pizza." The children really got into the chant. Then he urged everyone to hurry and buy a lightsaber before the show, to be the brightest side of the arena and win. Once the show started, things perked up, but after putting on 4 shows in 3 days, the Piccadilly performers looked tired. I would be too. When intermission rolled around 2 hours later, I left, feeling disappointed. I guess all the televised Barnum and Bailey circus specials had ruined me for this commercialized circus of the 90s. Still, the children had a great time, and the parents got a kick out of watching them. I should have rented a kid. Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Amanda Russell.
3, 2, 1. This year's conference focuses on cultural preservation. Executive Director Don Lee says traditionally topics such as death are only spoken of in certain situations, but the elders decided at last year's conference that it's time to make a change.
Cultural preservation traditionally was done orally. It wasn't something you documented, and you didn't put it on videotape, you didn't record it, and it was passed on. And the elders came to consensus in that method was not working, and something, we had to do something before a large number of the elders passed away that had this invaluable knowledge.
Dinakinaga provides a two-way dialogue. Elders share their stories and concerns with each other and the corporation. It is also a forum for information from tribal and governmental agencies. Tomorrow, the group will attend workshops on topics such as repatriation and language. In Nenana, I'm Teresa Bacher.
Three, two, one. After weeks of holding in the Copper River Delta, thousands of red salmon are moving upriver. As of Thursday, Fish and Game says more than 36,000 have passed their sonar counter. Still, late returns coupled with record takes by commercial fishers had dip netters crying foul. Now state biologists say they've changed the personal use opening in response to complaints. Biologist Andy Hoffman says instead of one 24-hour opening this Saturday, fishers will get 2 12-hour shots at salmon.
That's to spread out the harvest a little bit, and we've gotten a number of comments from the public concerning safety concerns by forcing the fishermen to fish straight through the night and cause potential hazards on their drives to and from the fishery. So we were able to accomplish that through this change of the timing of the 24-hour opener.
But Hoffman recommends fishers stay home this opening because few fish will have made it up to Chitna by the weekend. He says by mid-month, surging salmon numbers will make a dip netting trip worthwhile. Stan Bloom agrees. In fact, as vice president of the Chitna Dip Netters Association, he says fish numbers will be so low this weekend, the state ought to just close the opening altogether.
If there was lots of fish in the river, I would say, hey, this is a good idea, have this fish opening. But there's very few fish. Of course, the day periods are at least more reasonable. People won't be fishing all, trying to fish 24 hours straight to catch their fish. But if there's no fish, people will fish a long time down there, and they will come back disappointed.
Bloom says fish biologists have told him early returning salmon are critical for restocking some tributaries. But he says it sounds like they're contradicting themselves by holding this first low-run opening. Unless a lot more fish materialize, he worries the state will close the August fishery like last year, when many dip netters came up empty-handed. Bloom says his group will go to December's Fish Board meeting with those concerns to get a bigger share of fish. But that proposition worries Ken Johns, director of the Copper River Native Association. He says the political pressure dip netters are exerting on the board spells trouble for subsistence fishers.
There's family history and a commercial fisherman down in Cordova that I would like to see protected, and that the Chitna dip netters are latecomers into this, and that they should be in the line of allocation, the third user group, on a priority. I think there's enough fish to go around, but I have trouble of people calling themselves Chitna Dibnaners when they're actually predominantly from urban areas such as Fairbanks.
John says his group will fight any reduction to subsistence fishing quotas at this December's meeting. Meanwhile, fish biologists say fish numbers are now exceeding daily expectations, even though the overall total is still some 15,000 fish shy of predictions. Andy Hoffman says even though it started slow, the season may produce a bumper crop of salmon for all concerned. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Three, two, one. The Borough Assembly spent almost 3 hours Thursday night addressing a proposal before the legislature that would raise taxes on cigarettes to roughly $1.30 a pack. Citizens testifying at the special session broadly supported the Assembly resolution, which calls for the legislature to pass the tax. Former state legislator Glenn Hackney says raising the tax is good public health policy.
The heartening thing about it is, if you'll pardon the pun, a lot of people will be thankful in later years if this tax is passed, because the Heart Association, the Lung Association, the Cancer Association, they all have statistics that show the tremendous impact of smoking in this country totally, and here in Alaska.
Governor Knowles placed the tax on his special session agenda after House Speaker Gail Phillips killed the measure earlier this year, saying she wouldn't break her no new taxes pledge. State budget analysts predict the tax will raise between $10 and $40 million. Local opponents, including Two Rivers resident Jamie Cox, say any revenue earned by this new tax would be destined for the general fund and not for health care or education against tobacco use.
I think for the tobacco tax supporters to demonstrate their sincerity of this not being a revenue increaser and is truly for the health of the children, as they claim, that the governor and his supporters ought to voluntarily propose a $40 million budget cut to compensate for the $40 million revenue income they estimate they'll receive from this.
Other opponents fear the tax hike will create a black market for tobacco in Alaska. Assembly members Paul Chismar, Lad McBride, and Bob Logan voted against the resolution. Reasons for their opposition ranged from problems with the language to the bill's intent. Lane St. John joined them, criticizing the timing, and saw it as an effort to turn the tax into a political issue to embarrass House leaders. The legislature is set to take up the issue when it returns to Juneau Monday to finish the special session. In Fairbanks, I'm Amanda Russell.
Three, two, one. I got my first stitches in a garden. Just old enough to walk, I lurched along a stone wall between the new lawn and the new planting bed. I tottered doggedly toward my father and landed right on my face. Looking back on that garden, I mostly see my dad's handiwork there, a strawberry barrel that overflowed with fruit and vines, the table and chairs and chaise lounge he built and stained. I remember raking leaves under a big oak tree and mother kneeling among the tomatoes, heat and light, and a crimson bougainvillea, laundry on the line. Closing in on 50 now, I think mostly about that young couple just setting out in a house of their own, kids and a mortgage, putting in a lawn where there was dust and carving holes in a barrel hoping for berries. The first garden I made started out all rocks and river silt. My friend and I built a big screen on legs and shoveled dirt against it for days. We sweated and shoveled and carted off tons of stone. The little yard swallowed up truckloads of peat and topsoil and still felt like silt in the hand. We shoveled and shoveled, making parts flat for grass, parts into raised beds and pathways. Years later, that garden grew almost anything I asked it to, a lawn that felt cool and smelled fresh, sweet peas on the fences, rhubarb that was so excited about growing it shoved red knuckles through the snow every year and made way too much jam. Two big old choke cherries thrived after a big guy with a pot belly and strong hands pruned them back. They filled the house with scent in spring, made shade, looked handsome and dignified. It was never a gardener's garden. although I always loved planting the vegetables and annuals, loved the watering and the weeding. I think it was an inheritance for me, a place to watch transformations, to see what life looks like, turning from seed to shoot, to trunk and branch, to bud and flower and fruit. I learned something of patience and small pleasures there, the smell of things, the life in them. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McGinnis.
Salmon Story coming down in 3, 2, 1. On a routine flight a couple of years ago, an Alaska Department of Fish and Game biologist spotted thousands of chum salmon swimming up 4th of July Creek, a tributary of the Tekotna River.
And that really struck our interest, because previously we had, the general thought was that there weren't many salmon in general going up to the Tekotna River.
That's Department of Fish and Game fisheries biologist Doug Molyneux. With little solid information on upper Kuskokwim River area fisheries, his department wanted to know more about the Tekotna River salmon revival. After making a few calls, Molyneux found a research partner in the Tekotna Alternative School. Last summer, department biologists worked with the school and community to construct a fish counting tower, lay flash panels on the river bottom, and start counting salmon. This year, a two-week summer camp during the height of the chum run will bring additional student help to the six-week study. The Tekotna School's Helen Wittenkeller.
They'll actually be on the tower and counting salmon. They have little clickers as the salmon pass the panels, and you can actually just see them darting over the panels. It's pretty neat.
More than neat, the salmon study has struck a chord in the world of fish politics and science. Funding for the project includes $30,000 from the Bering Sea Fishermen's Association and $5,000 from Alaska Science and Technology, both grants secured by Tekotna School Principal Bart Mowry. Mowry hopes to broaden the project's scope in the future to research the reasons behind the demise and resurgence of Tekotna salmon. Meantime, if done consistently, Molyneux says the current count is useful to Fish and Game.
It won't just be an exercise to teach kids about salmon. It's going to provide some very useful information as far as the general numbers of fish that are going up that stream. And it will also provide information about the timing of the fish.
In McGrath, I'm Dan Broth.
3, 2, 1. Kabina, a Democrat from Valdez, serves as minority whip in the Republican-led House of Representatives. He says he's done as good a job for the district as he could. Kabina takes credit for helping to kill school funding and borough formation bills his constituents opposed. Also, the legislature passed a resolution he introduced in support of North Slope natural gas development. Kabina says he wants to continue to help make that development occur.
There are things that have to be done, and I think the biggest thing that the oil companies want to know is that they're going to have stability tax-wise during at least the financing phase of that pipeline, which would be about 25 years to finance, to pay that whole thing off. And I think there's things the state of Alaska can do in the legislature to ensure that's going to happen and make this project more viable.
Kabina says he'd also like to see more cohesion among rural legislators to counter the influence of Anchorage lawmakers. Kabina is the only Democrat who's filed to run for the District 35 seat, but he does have a Republican opponent, former Representative Harley Olberg of Delta Junction. Olberg held the seat last session and lost his re-election bid to Kabina. Olberg could not be reached for comment, while Kabina says they have different styles more than different positions.
I think I'm one that's open to people and listens to people and takes their concerns and tries to act on them whenever I can. And so I'm hopeful that the people recognize that and will send me back.
Kabina will be a seven-year veteran of the House if he's reelected. He served prior to Olberg's election in 1992 and lost the District R Senate race to Georgiana Lincoln that year. In Valdez, I'm Greg Williams.
3, 2, 1. For the last few years, Fish and Game has used a sonar system to count fish migrating up the Yukon River. But the department's main sonar specialist recently lost his job, so biologists won't use the sonar to make management decisions, such as opening a fall chum commercial fishery. Commercial Fisheries Director Bob Clasby.
The outlook was for perhaps a marginal commercial fishery. Like to be optimistic and hope that that happens, but that's where we're going to have to be conservative.
Clasby says after evaluating the situation, officials decided to run the pilot station sonar, but they'll depend on other test fisheries to assess run strength. Preseason projections put the fall chum run below average, just under the number needed to support a commercial fishery. Managers hoped they could allow a limited commercial fall chum fishery, but without confirmation from the sonar, Clasby says they'll be more conservative. The pilot station sonar project has long been difficult. Clasby says sonar systems become more tricky on wide, silty rivers like the Yukon. Paul Skavork was the department's main man on the job, but he was recently canned after a recommendation from the state personnel board when it found he had violated numerous ethics codes, including using his state job to enhance his private business.
He had inside his head that technical information on how these complex, self-configurable systems work. He essentially did a lot of the design and built them himself. And that information is just not resonant in anybody else's head, nor is it in any manuals or books.
Clasby says Skavork's loss leaves a hole in the department that he doesn't expect to fill in time for fishing. For this year, managers will use the data they gather, though they won't assign as much weight to its validity. That worries Dan Albrecht, director of the Yukon River Drainage Fisheries Association, who's concerned that the department will manage too conservatively.
With pilot station sonar being operated in this training mode, I'm concerned that the other indicators will show run strength being healthy, yet the department will still be hesitant because they're still unsure of the overall run size.
Albrecht says he hopes recent cooperation between fishers and managers on the Yukon has built enough trust to allow some commercial fishing if the run can support the harvest. Fall chum fishing starts in late summer. King and summer chum runs begin this month. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.